I'd like to thank Professor Blanco for an exceptional presentation. I fail to say that Professor Blanco is the president of the Spanish Orbit and Ocular Plastic Society. He is now a very big boy, and it's a pleasure to have him. Karen, thanks for being here. It's a great pleasure to have you from the other side of the city, Universidad de Montreal, and I hope you're going to transfer back to this side of the city. When I learned that you are all coming, and it's a great honor to have all of you, I cannot tell you what I felt and what I'll be feeling seeing all of you here. I thought we should dedicate part of this meeting to a special presentation. And the special presentation should be, of course, talking about pathology and ocular pathology, because that's what we do together. I spoke to one of the companies, Aperio, who does a lot of digital pathology and telemedicine, and the idea was to bring one of the experts in this new field of pathology to talk to us. We have here great pleasure to have Dr. Andrew Evans with us. He's a staff pathologist at the University Health Network in Toronto, and assistant professor of the Department of Pathology. Actually, everything in Toronto is more complicated. Then the part of pathology is not the part of pathology, it's the part of laboratory medicine and pathobiology. That's lovely. That's for Antonius. They're wonderful people. And we love you. And he's based in the Toronto General Hospital. And he's the man behind digital pathology in Toronto. He actually started with a very interesting story that I hope he's going to tell us, developing a system where frozen sections from one hospital, the results could be sent to another hospital, and images could be translated into, or could be sent to one hospital and interpreted in another hospital. And suddenly he was the man behind the digital pathology in the University of Toronto. I'd like again to thank Aperio for the opportunity of having Dr. Evans here. We're looking forward to our presentation. I think we have a lot of questions and a lot of good debates, and it's a great honor to have you, Dr. Evans.
Okay, so cool. Everyone can hear me all right? This okay. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. This one, okay. Thank you very much for the kind introduction, Miguel, and it's an honor and a privilege for me to be here participating in this conference that is recognizing the important 10-year anniversary of Dr. Bernier's ocular pathology laboratory. He took a couple of shots at me last night and actually again just now about coming from Toronto, so I thought I'd try and set the record straight. Yes, I was born in Toronto, but if it's of any redeeming value, my father grew up in Montreal West on Brock Avenue, and when I was a youngster, the hockey heroes that I heard stories about were Maurice Richard and Jean Béliveau. So I'm very much a Canadiens fan, and from where I sit with the series with Pittsburgh, it, from my perspective, it's very much allons-y les Canadiens. So, let's start here. Okay. So what I would like to do is just give you a perspective of our experience on the use of whole slide imaging for patient care in Toronto. And just by way of geography, University Health Network is a three-site academic complex in the downtown of Toronto. The consolidated pathology department sits here at the Toronto General. Across the road is across University Avenue is the Princess Margaret Hospital, and 1 mile to the west is the Toronto Western Hospital, which is home to the Kremble Neuroscience Center, and this is the site where the frozen sections arise that we read at this site digitally. So I'll take you through that story. So if I've done my job at the end of this presentation over the next 30, 35 minutes, you should have an understanding of why we use telepathology at UHN, what the driving forces were behind us implementing it, the steps that were required to implement the system and get it going, how it's actually performed and what lessons we've learned along the way, and there have been lessons, And then the current niche applications that we use for that we're using digital pathology in for day-to-day patient care at UHN. So we have expanded. And I should point out, we're not the only place that's doing this. There are certainly other telepathology systems that are up and going and are gaining experience in Canada and I think and elsewhere in other countries. And I think in terms of defining standards for best practice going forward, it's really going to come from the collective experience of all these institutions rather than one particular place. So what I'll mention to you this morning is something that we've used at our institution that works for us that may or may not be completely applicable in other centers. So by way of disclosure, I'll mention a couple of vendors like a Microsystems and Aperio, and I'd like to thank Pierre Defoe and the people from Aperio for sponsoring my trip here this morning. I'd point out that we have just vendor-client relationships with these companies only. We've also recently joined in with another digital pathology vendor, Omnix, which is based out of Pittsburgh, and we've joined their collaborators program. I won't mention anything about the Omnix work this morning. So by way of introduction, telepathology, just easily defined, most easily defined as providing pathology services over some distance. And the distance could be the next room, could be across a downtown, or it could be around the world. And essentially what we're doing is we're using the internet to link a pathologist in one location to glass slides in another. So diagnoses are being made from digital images. So this represents a major paradigm shift in the way diagnostic pathology is performed. And until very recently, the mainstay in the workhorse of digital pathology has been a robotic microscope, and now we're transitioning into the era of whole slide imaging and virtual microscopy, which I think will really move this technology forward. The concept of telepathology is certainly not new. Dr. Ronald Weinstein is the pathologist credited with actually coining the term telepathology back in the mid-1980s. There certainly has been a very successful program in Norway, which has used various modalities to look at primarily breast frozen sections over distances of hundreds of miles. Others in Europe, we certainly work very closely with a pathologist by the name of Keith Kaplan at Walter Reed Army Hospital. He's since left the U.S. military, but leveraging their experience in terms of digital pathology for U.S. military installations around the world. And there have been many others. I think it's important to point out here, this analogy is very apropos that this quote from Lee Iacocca, the former chairman of Chrysler, that once a new technology hits you, if you're not part of the steamroller, you're going to be part of the road. And I think this is very appropriate here on many levels, that there's digital pathology is here to stay, it's going to come, it's gaining momentum, but a steamroller moves slowly. It's not the fastest vehicle on the face of the earth, but it's very difficult to stop it. And I think this very much describes the phenomenon that we'll see with digital pathology. So the three uses that we've had for it at our institution, first and foremost, primary frozen section diagnoses. So I'll take you through that story. We've since expanded it to provide subspecialty pathology services to two hospitals in northeastern Ontario, in Timmins and Sault Ste. Marie. And finally, a transplant pathologist, particularly our liver pathologists, have used this to maintain around-the-clock subspecialty coverage of ultra-rush transplant biopsies. So in terms of the geography, I just described the basic layout of University Health Network. Here's Toronto General, Princess Margaret across from the road on University Avenue, and then the Toronto Western site over here. Now, as I mentioned, the Toronto Western site's home to the Kremble Neuroscience Center. It generates roughly 2 to 10 frozen sections per week, so it's not a high volume of frozen sections, but nonetheless, they require coverage. Now, in late 2003, 2004, early 2004, a number of factors kind of conspired to push us into the digital pathology world. The first one was that we knew our pathology department was going to fully consolidate here at Toronto General. So we were actually going to lose on-site pathology presence at Toronto Western. So it would mean having to run over there back and forth to cover the frozen sections when they arose. The other one was We had two neuropathologists on staff at the time, one of whom had indicated an intention to retire. The other one was very much looking for a different academic opportunity, which eventually did come up in another institution. So he left, so we had no neuropathologist to cover these things. So the obvious problems that were to be solved here, we had the issue of a single pathologist traveling over there to cover a frozen section. Also, people, myself and a couple of other pathologists in the department, had done some extra neuropathology training and were comfortable looking at them, but we weren't doing it on a regular basis. So it's always nice to have another colleague there to be able to look at a difficult frozen section with you. And if you had a single person on site, you couldn't really do that. That wasn't an option. The traveling over there was becoming increasingly disruptive, given that 99% of our activity took place over at the Toronto General site. So there were delays in regular sign-out that affected other UHN patients if you had to go over to Toronto Western, and you might be out of your office for 2 to 3 hours waiting for one frozen section. If there were changes in the OR schedule or some interoperative complication. And then finally here, again, I mentioned the no possibility for consultation with colleagues on difficult cases. So this represents a possible compromise to diagnostic accuracy and also definitely increased the number of deferred diagnoses. So digital pathology was really an answer to all of these. It prevented us from having to travel over there. We were able to keep working on other things and without having to deal with the downtime of traveling and waiting, and we were able to consult with colleagues. So in terms of basic planning, we had to identify a core team, and this is really crucial if you're considering implementing this at your institution. We had to identify a couple of pathologists, myself and one other person, to champion and validate the technology to make sure that it would work and be safe and accurate. Histotechnologists, I can't emphasize this enough. I'll mention this several times. Digital pathology is very much a garbage-in, garbage-out phenomenon. If you put very poor quality slides in a slide scanner, it doesn't matter how good the slide scanner is, you won't get a good image with it, at least with the current technology. So a histotechnologist who can produce high-quality and consistently high-quality frozen section slides is a must. We also needed a dedicated UHN IT person. This was certainly not something that would be a help desk issue, where at any time a problem arose, you call and speak to a generic customer service person and explain the whole system and then explain what exactly the problem is. You need someone who actually really understands the system and actually helped you set it up. And then lastly, the vendor. Local support is another very crucial element here. Having a vendor that will understand your system, your needs, and will help tailor their system to best suit it. Validation of the technology for your specific needs, that's another very crucial component here. Obviously, there are cost and budget issues. There will be some changes in workflow, which perhaps we can get to in the discussion if people have questions around that. You need to develop contingency plans if the system goes down, and then there is due diligence to cover as well. Very briefly, our in-house validation. Myself and one other pathologist worked away over an 18-month period before we introduced this into patient care, going through 300 consecutive archive frozen sections that reflected the case mix and slide quality from the Toronto Western site. And we basically asked ourselves, can we make a diagnosis on the digital image? If not, why not? And we had not actually seen any of these frozen sections before, so these were completely new cases to us, although retrospectively. And it became very apparent that with the system we started with, which was a robotic microscope, after about 20 cases, that this was going to work, and it was going to work very well. This is the due diligence I mentioned. There's the in-house and training. We dealt with our medical malpractice insurance provider. We contacted CMPA to make sure that there wouldn't be any effect on coverage. We had to develop an SOP, standard operating procedure, for approval by our medical advisory committee. We touched base with Health Canada, which at the time they had no, there was no particular sign-off from Health Canada on these devices, although this will change. They will be developing a classification scheme now to consider them as medical devices. And importantly, we had to engage the cooperation of our surgeon colleagues. So we actually brought them in, showed them the technology, and explained to them how this system was going to work and how they could help us to help them with it. So how have we done? Well, we started in November of 2004 using a Leica robotic microscope. And we reviewed 350 frozen sections with no on-site pathologist. We found it to be every bit as accurate as a light microscope. Our deferral rate was under 10%, which was actually better than when we had one pathologist over there struggling away with cases and without anyone to show slides to. But the one thing we did find is with a robotic microscope, this particular one was very slow. It would take us roughly 10 minutes to look at one slide and be absolutely comfortable that we had seen everything properly. So now we enter into the whole slide imaging, which just by a show of hands, are most people familiar with what the technology looks like? I have a representative slide that I can show you quickly here. So this is what we've used, the Aperio ScanScope. And since switching over to that in October of 2006, we've now done over 1,800 frozen sections from 1,400 patients, 90% of which have come from neurosurgery. Our overall accuracy is every bit as good as it was with the light microscopy, and actually it's actually better than when we had one pathologist there. In terms of turnaround time, from the time the tissue arrives in our laboratory to the time we're calling a surgeon, we're solidly averaging 14 to 16 minutes turnaround time, which is well within the College of American Pathologists standard of 20 minutes turnaround time. Our deferral rate's fallen even further to 7.5%, where we haven't been able to give a neurosurgeon a definitive diagnosis, but perhaps a differential. And we've actually, this technology has allowed us to institute a policy whereby whenever one person, if you're considering making a deferred diagnosis, at least one other colleague sees it first. And we can do this in real time without causing a prolonged delay in turnaround time. So this, as I said, this would simply be impossible if we had one pathologist on site doing it. So there's a definite quality benefit here. Now I'll just switch very quickly and I'll show you an example of a frozen section, a typical frozen section. So this would be a ring-enhancing large intraaxial mass, and this gives you an idea of the size of the pieces of tissue. So they're generally between five and 10 millimeters. This is quite typical, just around the 5-6 millimeter mark. These are the sizes of the biopsies that we get. Our histotechnologist cuts frozen sections that, based on my experience, are like most people's permanent paraffin-embedded sections, which has really allowed us to do this. And then in terms of the software, it's just like Google Earth or Google Maps. It's a drag and point viewer interface. Here you can see this actually projects even more clearly on the screen. On my computer screen, but you can clearly see it's an astrocytic process or astrocytic tumor with the processes. And if we go back, I just highlighted a couple of other details that would allow us to call this a high-grade astrocytoma. Let's see, zoom in here. So hopefully here you can see, you can readily appreciate mitotic figures. And another feature that we would typically look for in this scenario would be endothelial proliferation within the tumor, which is shown here with this arrow. So this gives you just an idea of the image quality and the ease of navigation compared to the robotic microscope. It very much more closely replicated the viewing experience down a light microscope. And to be honest, it's been my experience now that when the low power overview image of the frozen section appears, I find the area of interest almost immediately on this, as opposed to having to hunt around with a light microscope. I find those details more quickly, but it really does depend on the quality of the slide, and I can't emphasize that strongly enough. Okay. We're continue back on here. So this describes the architecture. Here's the computer that's hooked up to the Aperio scanner at our Toronto Western site. We just go through our local area network. The pathologists, these are the PCs in the pathologist offices. So we can, as many people as necessary, can go through the local area network directly to this PC. So we don't actually move these images over because the files can be quite large. I'll mention that a little bit later. We actually go to where the images are, and they're streamed across the local area network, and we view them. So this, again, allows easy consultation with colleagues, which we think is better for patient care. And the interesting thing is, in comparison to the time it took for us to learn the robotic microscope with the whole slide imaging, there was essentially no learning curve. We literally made a transition from the robot to this technology in just over a month. So it was very fast. Now, in terms of scanning magnification, our default protocol actually is to scan the slides at 20x and reserve going to a 40x scan only if we need it. So if you look at this piece of tissue, this is actually the same frozen section I showed you the actual digital image of. It would take roughly 1 minute to scan this 6-millimeter piece of tissue at 20x, and it generates a file size that's around 35 megabytes. If you do the same slide at 40x, it'll take you closer to 4 minutes to scan it, and the file size will be about four times as big. So it's been our experience, and then this I think would be an important thing for others to validate in their own situation and for their own comfort level. But we haven't actually needed this extra firepower that comes from 40x. So our default, as I say, is 20x. Here's an example of a meningioma. We actually do intraoperative smears as well, and these are still images taken directly from a whole slide scan. So the image quality for us has been outstanding. Has it always been smooth sailing? Well, the answer is no. We've learned some lessons along the way. How often have we had to rescan slides? It's been fewer than 2% of cases where the pathologist has said, you know, there's a particular area here that's just not well focused. So what we do is what you would do is if you were the frozen section pathologist right in the surgical pathology lab with a light microscope, you'd ask the technician to cut another slide. So we do that. The take-home here should be that histotechnology is the key. Good quality slides will give you good quality digital images. And when we have had to recut or rescan them, it's typically because there's been some issue, like a large fold in the slide, or there's been tremendous ice crystal freezing artifact, or the section is too thick. Okay. Episodes of system failure. This is another one. I think we would have been naive to enter into this and figure that everything would work all the time. We've had two episodes of pre-case failure, which were both detected on a system check that we do every single morning. So the pathologist who's covering the frozen sections at the Toronto Western site will log into the system, view a test slide, communicate with the histotechnologist, and make sure that the system is working properly long before the frozen sections arrive. And then we usually discuss the OR list for the day and plot a plan as to when the frozen sections will likely come. There were two episodes where there's one where the network went down, where obviously we couldn't connect right away, so we sent a pathologist over to the Western site, and we did it the old-fashioned way. The other one, which was a little bit embarrassing, the scanner was moved to a different network drop in the surgical pathology lab, and our IT support people had indicated that it would keep the same static IP address, which we plugged it in, checked it right after it had been moved, and everything was fine. But unbeknownst to us, it was actually a dynamic IP address, and when the machine was shut down during the night, the IP address was no longer functional for the scanner. And so in the morning test run, we couldn't connect with it. We have had four episodes, which represent actually less than 0.3% of cases where we've had mid-case failure, where we just had to send a pathologist over the mile over to the west to read the slide with a light microscope. And those were minute pale pieces of tissue in two cases. Actually, three cases it happened. where the scanner just simply, in quotation marks, wouldn't recognize the piece of the tissue. They wouldn't distinguish the piece of tissue from the white background. But we were able to work with the vendor to develop a faint slide protocol, and now that's not a problem. So that was a lesson learned. And the other one, which you know is not really surprising, we had one episode where excess mounting media came out from underneath the cover slip, got on top of it, and fouled the scanner objective. And that would require about 45 minutes to an hour to take the objective out and clean it, which clearly wouldn't allow you to do a frozen section in a reasonable amount of time. So that's another thing, again, you know, a histotechnology detail. You have to be very careful about the slides you put in. Now here's an example. I'll show you a case where initially we missed it, but the diagnostic detail was actually there. So this was a 33-year-old female with multiple enhancing lesions on brain MRI. She had a very low CD4 count. Her HIV status wasn't known, but at you know, this particular level, it's very clear what's going on. So the clinical differential diagnosis was a CNS lymphoma in the setting of immunosuppression versus infection in an immunocompromised host, and the one they were worried about was toxoplasmosis. So we did 20 and 40 scans, 40x scans up front. The only thing we could find, and there were three of us that spent time going through the virtual slide, we saw largely necrotic brain. We didn't see lymphoma. We couldn't rule out an infection, but we couldn't actually see anything, so we deferred to a paraffin diagnosis. And in other material that was better preserved, and actually we didn't look at it frozen section, you could see there was a bradyzoid, so we were able to make a diagnosis of toxoplasmosis. Now we went back during the QA portion, we went and reviewed the light microscope slide of the frozen section. We were able to find a couple of these things. We were concerned that maybe we would miss this on the digital image, so we went back there, and lo and behold, it actually was there. We didn't see it at the time. So it can be done. We've published this experience in Human Pathology in the August 2009 issue, so you can get all of the information in nauseating detail if you wish there. Now, how have we expanded this whole slide imaging for patient care? I'd mentioned at the start that we've expanded it to provide service to Timmins and Sault Ste. Marie, both of which where there are shortages of pathologists, particularly in Timmins. And we've used it for, particularly in Timmins, for actually making primary frozen section diagnoses when there's no on-site pathologist there. And it's also been very important in streamlining sending cases for consultation, triaging cases that may need to be sent down in their entirety to Toronto for detailed immunohistochemical workup or molecular studies that simply aren't available in those centers. So here's just by way of geography, Toronto here, Timmins there, 400 miles away. We've actually done, since April 2008, we've actually done, it's now closer to 150 primary frozen sections. And with done it completely digitally, and it's worked very well. Likewise, at Sault Ste. Marie, we've used it. There's always a pathologist on site there, at least one, but we've used it for pathologist-to-pathologist consultations, and it's worked very well. The final expansion point for whole slide imaging at our institution has been with on our transplant service, particularly with orthotopic liver transplants. So we do, UHN does roughly 600 orthotopic liver transplants biopsies per year, and these are done on a largely an urgent basis. So they all require same day or next morning reporting. We do have three pathologists who are highly skilled and experienced at reporting these biopsies, but in some cases they've all been away for continuing medical education activities, and they needed some ability to consult with, or the on-call colleague who's left back in Toronto really needed some sort of expertise to lean on when they were dealing with these biopsies, which are highly nuanced. And so this was a way of doing it. So we worked with our IT department to develop a virtual private network, or VPN access, to come in, and we developed a pathology portal here, which is username and password protected. So the off-site pathologist, regardless of where they are, anywhere in the world. As long as the internet is functioning, they can come in, tunnel in directly through the firewall to the slide scanner that they need to get to where the case is. They can open up that particular case and report it. And they've done actually 40 biopsies this way that cover the whole gamut of questions that you would encounter in liver transplant pathology. So rejection, potential donor biopsies, non-transplant medical liver disease. And the important thing here is the hepatologists who work with these three pathologists are highly satisfied with this because they get the people that they deal with, you know, Monday to Friday on a regular basis. So they're all on the same page. It's not the same as putting another pathologist who doesn't work with these people on a regular basis in that situation of having to make a diagnostic interpretation, especially when it's really crucial. So it's worked really well for us. We've expanded it so that we have one dermatopathologist. When he was away, this was actually a very tricky bullous skin disease, which came as an ultra rush. And this fellow was actually at the U.S. Canadian Academy of Pathology meeting when this case came in. Pathologist back home in Toronto was a little uncomfortable with offering up a differential diagnosis, and so we were able to scan the slide and get Danny Gazarian, our dermatopathologist, to have a look at it from Boston at the time. And then he spoke directly with the dermatologist by cell phone, and the case worked very well. We also have a large number of cardiac transplants. We have one cardiovascular pathologist who looks at the RV biopsies, Jagdish Bhutani. He has the ability to look at cardiac biopsies and actually had looked at, we had him set up so when he went to a meeting in Australia that if any situation arose that he would be able to get in and have a look at the case and help the colleague back home. And also renal pathology as well. We've used it for a number of post-transplant kidney biopsies. So the summary experience, we found this to be safe, reliable, and accurate. Hopefully I've given you the impression that there's tremendous value added in terms of patient quality, largely by being able to consult colleagues. This is the team, and I can't thank Dr. Sylvia Aza enough. She's our department chief, and she, without her vision and actually encouraging a couple of us to get this whole system going, we would never be where we are. Thanks to Sylvia for that. Here's the day-to-day team that makes the whole system work. This is Dr. Ranjan Chetty, who worked with me initially. We worked together to develop and validate the robotic telepathology program. This is Suganthi Ilalagan. She's sort of, I would say, is really the star of the show, the histotechnologist who cuts these fabulous frozen sections. She's actually been able to work with and train 9 other histotechs so that, you know, realizing that Suganthi will not always be at work, she has to take vacation, et cetera. So she's been able to work with other folks as well to train them to cut these beautiful frozen sections that make the whole thing work. And I thought I would close with one very hopefully amusing story. When we first started doing this with the robotic microscope, it's a very small circle of surgeons that we dealt with on a regular basis. There was one particular case where there was a neurosurgeon was involved because there was a Pancoe's tumor, a non-small cell lung cancer that had been treated with radiation and chemotherapy, and there was a suspicion that there was a recurrence in and around the brachial plexus. So there was a thoracic surgeon who does not normally operate over at the Toronto Western site who came in to assist in the procedure with the neurosurgeon. And the neurosurgeon was sending a number of frozen sections. And this was actually about the time we were doing these things by the robotic microscope, which, as I mentioned, was a little on the slow side. So the surgeon had sent 4 or 5 frozen sections, and it was coming up toward the end of the day. And I said, I asked him if he was going to send more. He was sending these margins. And he said, yeah, there could be 3 or 4 more. And this was the thoracic surgeon who doesn't normally work with work over there. And I said, well, if, you know, that being said, I pass by the Toronto Western on my way home. I'll actually come over there. And he said, what do you mean come over there? And I said, well, I'm at Toronto General. I'm reading the frozen section. And he said, well, how are you reading the frozen sections? And I said, well, we're doing this by using a robotic microscope, by telepathology. And I kid you not, this is what I heard. He took the phone away. He was scrubbed out of the case. He took the phone away from his ear, and he said to the neurosurgeon who we worked with all the time, He said, it's amazing. They're doing these frozen sections by telepathy. So perhaps that is the way forward, and maybe we will use crystal balls at some point. So hopefully this has been informative for you, and it'll stimulate some discussion. And I know there, Dr. Bernier is going to come up and perhaps describe his vision as to how this could fit in Montreal. But thank you very much.
Thank you. It's wonderful to see how great Toronto has become. And that was an amazing lecture. That was fantastic. Questions and comments? This is Dr. Belfort. He is the professor and chair in...
Well, congratulations. Beautiful lecture.
Oh,
interesting
you.
That you probably know that Scientific America made this year. There's a very interesting
article on that
new lens. Yeah. And I found it so interesting that I brought some copies to ask Miguel about. So as usual, Miguel is at the edge. And before I ask him questions, he brings the lecture. Excellent. We anticipate that Patel is going to be more and more useful in the near future towards that. But how early this is going to be? We're talking about long-term, mid-term. See, I'm old enough to see that things that I started hearing when I was 15 years old, such as interferon, it still goes on. Well, what's what is the most probable scenario for 5 and 10 years on that?
Well, I think it's been interesting. If we just look at the evolution of this whole process in our department, recognizing it's such a major paradigm shift in the way pathologists make diagnoses, and pathologists, I think it's safe to say that most of us are extremely conservative when it comes to implementing change. And the Scientific American article that you talked about, starts out by saying pathologists have done the same thing the same way for 100 years. And there really isn't any other area of medicine that's kind of stayed stagnant like that. You introduce some major shift or major change to a group of pathologists like that, typically what you're going to get will be, the first response will be 100 reasons why you should never do it. It's dangerous, it's inaccurate, it's this, it's that, and the images are nice, but it's not the same as a microscope. And I've heard that over and over again. And to be honest, when we first started with it, that was kind of my mindset. I wasn't completely ready to write it off, obviously, but I had to sort of be shown as like a doubting Thomas before, and I actually had to see that it could work. And then once you develop a comfort level with the technology, it will sell itself to you. We've seen that in our department. There was, as I mentioned, there was myself and one other person that were real willing to get it going. We're now up to it's probably close to 20 pathologists who are involved in it now and are comfortable using this for different purposes. So I think the way, in a broad sense, it will likely be introduced the way we did it here in niches. People, different institutions will identify specific needs that this technology can fit into and help them solve problems. And then once they get comfortable with that particular application, they'll expand it to other ones. And I think as more pathologists get a chance to work with it in controlled settings, like we've used it here, I think you'll see it roll out. In terms of when, would we ever get rid of microscopes and go completely digital? I don't think in my lifetime we will. Perhaps at some point we'll go to like radiology, going to where it became a completely filmless specialty. We might go on a day-to-day basis to doing everything digitally, but when that will happen, I can't tell you.
Yeah, but it will have to come, right?
Yeah.
How many exams of these? How many pathological exams are done in Canada a year, roughly?
How many, like?
Yeah, cases that go to all the labs in Canada.
It's huge.
How many?
I don't think I could. You mean consultation-type cases?
We don't know. We don't know either.
No,
nobody knows. And first, you have to know. And probably we would need, 1 million exams a day.
Yeah.
2 million exams a day. It's the only way to do it through this new mechanism, because otherwise we'll never be able to meet the social needs, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And, of course, we always knew that computers would never work in 1940s. Thank you very much.
Yeah. No, there's no question. I think it's a powerful enabler for not only for quality patient care, consultation on difficult cases, but also teaching for research. I mean, the list is really endless.
Another question. Dr. Alex Odashiro,
yes.
He's a pathologist. Also found resilient that
before I start, yes. Say, Miguel is not going to be able to solve this, but his daughter will. Sure. Julie, please do it.
Alex Odashiro is doing a postdoc with us. He's a doctor of pathology, does full training pathologist. You're going to see here a combination of ophthalmologists, pathologists, scientists, oncologists, dermatologists. Alex.
Hi, yes. Dr. Rivas. Morning, congratulations for your talk.
Oh, thank you.
And as a pathologist, like, we're seeing this technology in all the Congress that are coming, USCAP, Canadian Academy of Pathology, and all of them, they are putting the slides, they're scanning the slides and be available to everybody looking before the yeah. meeting. So in the next IEP that we are going to have in Brazil, the International Academy of Pathology, we are going to do slide seminars, and they asked to send all these slides because they are going to be all scanned.
Yes.
And to be there for everybody to see before the meeting, then we can discuss the slides. So I think this is a really good technology, and I've seen some cases by this, and I'm not sure if it was from a peer or not, but they're like perfect to see, I think.
Yeah.
And also, I want just to know, because I think you helped Dr. Gilda Cunha.
Yes.
Yeah, to scan some slides. She's from Brazil. Mm-hmm. And I asked her to scan, so probably you did it with her. And I'd like to know if you can tell what's the cost of today to set up
Another potential barrier that to implementing the technology, I didn't mention during the presentation, but from our particular perspective, we've spent just the basic system with a slide scanner and IT support, et cetera, between Toronto General and Toronto Western. You know, the startup cost was in the order of $120,000 Canadian dollars, which if you put these things into perspective. If you consider a robotic surgical instrument, the Da Vinci robot that urologists at our institution are using, that's $2.5 million to buy that. And I was actually at a presentation conference last week in Victoria, British Columbia, with a number of hospital executives who were interested in learning about this technology, the digital pathology piece, and they all basically said you can buy a tremendous number of scanners for one Da Vinci robot. So, well, to an individual pathology department and their budget, it might seem like a fairly large upfront cost, but it will certainly pay for itself down the road.
I have a question for Dr. Evans. Could you comment on, and you did some specialty work, because that's one we are very interested in.
Yes.
For example, we are the largest doctor pathologists in the country, and there are very few of them that can offer the services we do. Also, some of them, the ocular pathologist that had training in ocular pathology is retiring or is moving, as you said, then at a certain point in time, and we are receiving a lot of consultations, some of through telepathology, the old style telepathology,
yes.
Meaning you need a person at the other end
yes.
that knows ocular pathology to send you messages. But this is going to be really a real problem for us, particularly here. The number of consultations we'll be receiving, and the desire of serving yeah. other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on how we could organize subspecialty work?
Yeah, I think there's a challenge that if you were to put, if your budget was limitless and you could put slide scanners in all of these various places that you receive consults from, if those of you who have seen the movie Field of Dreams, there was a quote in there, if you build it, they will come. And so you got a guy who had built a baseball diamond and these ghosts from baseball players who had long since passed away would come back and play on this field. And I think there is certainly this kind of a phenomenon here that if you put in a system like this, all of a sudden it will start attracting a lot of consults and then you could find yourself actually being overwhelmed by them. So you have to make sure that you'd have sufficient resources in place to read the slides. So that would be, you know, one challenge for sure. Have enough people in your specialty center to be able to keep up with the consults in a timely manner. And then on the other side, I think would be the having budget in place and planning, and the IT issue is a major one when you're talking about connecting different centers and you have different firewall issues, and we certainly have encountered some of those growing pains with between Timmins and Sault Ste. Marie.
Can you make an also comment about the size of the specimens? Because size in orthopedic pathology, a big size, 10 millimeters, huge.
Yes.
Besides the marble of tumors, everything is very small, and everything is a lot of detail.
Yeah.
Any problems with very small size in digital pathology?
No, the only ones I'd mentioned that where we had a problem were pieces of very pale edematous brain tissue that you'd have to make some adjustments in your basic scanner settings in order to be able to scan them. But for us, I think the fact we get such good quality digital images are largely due to the fact we get these very flat, high quality frozen sections, but they're small. So, you know, we have seen just in some other work that we've done when we've scanned larger pieces of tissue, you have to spend more time working up the optimizing the focal maps in order to get a really good quality scanned image. You will find areas, say, if you looked at a section from a radical prostatectomy, which could be 3-4 centimeters across, if you were to do a large hole mount image that way, you will find areas that won't be as well scanned, and you have to pay more attention to it. So the small ones, I think you're, as long as you have good histology, it'll work well.
More questions? Like again to thank Dr. Evans. That was a fantastic presentation, and we're very honored that you could come here. I think to bring a new way of seeing our work is extremely important, particularly in ocular pathology, where we're going to deal with a lot of consultations. I always thought we should bring the best to our meetings, and certainly we start very well. This was a presentation that was impeccable. There's a presentation that shows that Toronto is as good as Montreal, and I hate to say that, but I have to, and shows that young pathologists can do a great work. Before I let you go, I have two things. One is your certificate that you're going to remember the meeting that you attend, and this is from all of us to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, I think it's time for a break.